Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We will have some fun with numbers later this hour, numbers and pop music. We'll also check in with some people in North Carolina to see how unsettled the Muslim community is there after a brutal shooting of three young Muslim students that police have yet to establish as a religiously motivated crime. But we begin with some terrifying geography of the 21st century. The arbitrary map of the world drawn by colonial masters at the end of World War I a century ago seems to be slowly coming apart. It's not reverting to some post-colonial pastoral equilibrium in Africa and the Middle East and Asia. There are simply large areas of lawless, ungovernable chaos. Think of Ukraine. Think of Syria. In some areas, people have grown up and died without ever having a government around them, such as the case for Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, where there is neither a democratic republic or any kind of government. Areas of Chechnya, parts of Pakistan, out of reach of the government in Islamabad, while the northeast of Nigeria is a place of radicalization, the home of the Boko Haram terrorists. Here to help us think about the millions of people, and the number is growing, the millions of people growing up without laws or a government, are Manji Cheto, risk analyst on the political economy of sub-Saharan Africa at Teneo, a global advisory firm, and also Ambassador Nicholas Burns, former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs under President George W. Bush. He's now professor of the practice of diplomacy and international politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Ambassador Burns, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And Manji Cheto, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
How much would you say the statelessness of millions of people around the world is an international security concern, Ambassador Burns?
Oh, I think it's looming to be one of the major concerns of the 21st century. If you think of the last century, the 20th century, it was really interstate conflict between states, World War I and II, that dominated. Right now, we're looking at massive displacement of people inside states because of conflicts within states. Think of Darfur, Congo. And now think of Syria, where half the population is homeless, 11 million out of 22 million. So how does one respond to this? How do we hold governments to account when, in fact, in Syria, it's the Syrian government that is brutalizing its own people? And in Nigeria, it's a hapless and ineffectual government that can't counter Boko Haram. I think it's a major challenge.
Manji Cheto, looking at Nigeria, how close is the north of Nigeria to being a distinct lawless, ungovernable state on its own?
Well, I think, you know, you need to, there certainly is a disconnect between kind of what happens in northeast Nigeria to what happens in the rest of the country. And you know, just for perspective, Nigeria is an incredibly large country. And you would be forgiven if you were kind of sitting even somewhere up north, like Kano, thinking that actually nothing is happening. And you can give you a false sense of peace. Now, the picture is certainly very different if you go to the northeastern states in the extreme northeast corner of Nigeria, where virtually the state feels completely absent, and it actually feels like a militarized zone. But I think in the context where nation states and territories have been drawn across, I mean, if one part of a state is falling apart, then it does give the impression actually that effectively the state is a failed state. But I think I'm not quite sure that I would make the argument that Nigeria is at that stage yet, but it's certainly the risk continues to grow on a daily basis.
You know, it's almost the case, Ambassador Burns, that a failed state is one condition, but an even more destabilizing condition could be an institutionalized chaos like you have, for instance, in Pakistan. Northwest Frontier Province has been a kind of stateless, ungoverned territory that is sort of accepted within the Pakistan government, even though no one would say Pakistan is a failed state. Northwest Frontier Province is a place well known for radicalization.
Well, that's right. And even in the British Empire, the Northwest Frontier Province was both ungoverned and some would say ungovernable. The same is true, has been true with Pakistani rule. And we've seen what's happened. We've seen that it's that part of the world that has become really ground zero for many of the terrorist groups that have been striking at the Afghan people and at the United States and at India, for that matter. So I think a major preoccupation of global leaders today is when do we intervene in someone else's internal affairs and when do we not? We saw that President Clinton intervened successfully in Bosnia and Kosovo to stop two wars, but then we had a major problem in the intervention of Iraq in 2003. We face that question today in a way. just been a ceasefire agreement in Ukraine? How much should we be intervening in the affairs of Ukraine to help the Ukrainian government against Russian rebels? And I'll come back to Syria, John, because I think it's the greatest humanitarian crisis in the world today. There's not another major state where half of its population has lost their homes, lost their jobs, living in makeshift camps because of the brutalization of its own government, but also terrorist groups like ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra. And it puts a major responsibility on the powerful states like the United States to make these big decisions. When do we intervene in a war? When do we stand back?
And Ambassador Burns, if we use Iraq as an example, the transition from Saddam Hussein to some sort of democratic civic order, it passes through this territory of statelessness. And even if Bashar al-Assad were to fall tomorrow, Syria's trajectory into something more stable is completely unknown at this point, based on the precedents.
Well, that's really the tragedy. Even if, as you say, even if Assad were to leave, there's no reason to believe that the situation would be better. As Lakhdar Brahimi, the UN negotiator, said quite famously, Syria is melting away. It's really ceased to exist as a nation state. It's riven by this conflict between Shia and Sunni Islam, the Christian and Kurdish populations just trying to survive. And I think we'll see a struggle for power in Syria, no matter who's in charge in Damascus for some time to come.
Manji Cheto, in Nigeria, would Boko Haram be able to take that territory and wall it off from the rest of Nigeria? Or could Nigeria and the Nigerian government simply just jettison the northeast province without any sort of consequence to Nigeria as a whole?
Let me pick up on the last point. There's always going to be consequences, irrespective of whether or not Boko Haram can actually take over the state, because already, you know, we're already seeing cases of internally displaced people. That's having a knock-on effect in community relations across the north. With that said, I mean, there's currently no evidence to suggest that while Boko Haram actually has moved and actually destroyed some of the state institutions in the northeast, they actually have not replaced it with any sort of form of governance. So I think that in itself points to the fact that they probably will be unable to actually completely displace a government and actually install something that kind of looks like a quasi-government, so to speak. With that said, if any state institutions are actually eroded, it certainly does create anarchy, in which case this instability then remains in a constant state of flux, which for neighbouring countries, I mean, if you kind of look at the map of Nigeria and the northeast corner of Nigeria, it is bordering Cameroon, it's bordering Chad. It's also a key route in the Trans-Sahelian trade route. So actually, you know, if that happens, while the impact might be quite limited in Nigeria, it's actually quite significant from a regional security point of view. One thing that is quite clear is that Boko Haram and the instability that it is creating is certainly opening up more room for other terrorist groups operating in the Sahel to find a safe haven. And I think that's really where the main argument is here. So while, you know, domestically, I think there's a level of kind of skepticism about having, foreign intervention, I think the Nigerian government has tried to make the argument that really the international community has to see this as an international stake and actually support the Nigerian government.
Ambassador Burns, I want to end on something really in more human terms here. Choose whatever stateless, ungovernable zone you care to. What message would you send, or what perspective would you expect from a 10 or 11-year-old boy or girl growing up in northeast Nigeria or Chechnya or Georgia or Syria? What's their future in this century?
Well, I can't imagine what it would be like to be a young Syrian kid these days, because you see your parents have lost their jobs. You've lost your family home. You've been living out in the open, even in the winter, just trying to flee your own government, which is firing barrel bombs into your city, or these vile terrorist groups that are doing the same. And these poor innocent civilians are caught between terrorist groups and a depraved government. And really no hope, because the international community is not coming in a big way. No one's sending in a peacekeeping force to separate those parties or conduct a ceasefire. And, you know, these kids, many of them are now in refugee camps in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Syria, but and Jordan. But the majority of them are inside their own country, but with no hope to return to normal life. And I think it's the saddest situation we see in the world today.
Manji, what's it like to live in the northeast of Nigeria? If you're a young teenage boy or girl, what's your future? What do you think?
Well, you know, I think what the Boko Haram insurgency has done, it's effectively robbed a whole generation of Nigerians in the northeast of their innocence, of their youth. And you're constantly living under a fear of attack. I should state here that, you know, the attack is not just so much a fear of attack from a terrorist group, but it's also a fear of attack on whether or not, you know, security forces will perceive you to be a threat. I think this is one of the issues certainly Western partners have raised in Nigeria. To what extent can the military actually guarantee that it is protecting human rights? So really, I mean, that the situation is quite dire. We do have a humanitarian crisis on our hand in northeast Nigeria. It is the issue that is less discussed, but it is significant. And also in the internally displaced camps, there are very worrying reports of child rape and child abuse. And this issue needs to be looked at quite closely and actually taken up by the international community.
She's a risk analyst on the political economy of sub-Saharan Africa at Teneo, a global advisory firm. Manji Cheto joined us from Abuja. Manji, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thoughts on the tragedy of statelessness from Ambassador Nicholas Burns, former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs under President George W. Bush. He's now professor of the practice of diplomacy and international politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Ambassador, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, John.
I'm Bob Simon.
Some somber thoughts now about a horrible tragedy here in New York City last night. Legendary journalist Bob Simon of CBS News died in a car accident. He was 73. He was, quite simply, one of the most intelligent, fearless, knowledgeable, steady, and dashing people to ever work in television news. He covered nearly every overseas story since the 1960s. He was a brilliant writer. I actually worked with him in Israel back in the 1980s. He probably won't even remember it or would never remember it. He was on a first-name basis with everyone in the Israeli government who would take his calls at any hour of the night. And as I discovered one harrowing night smuggling tapes out of the Gaza Strip under curfew during the first Intifada, I was stopped by masked Palestinians who threatened me until I showed them a videotape with a CBS logo on it. When I mentioned Bob Simon, the fierce militants safely escorted me out of Gaza, and all along the way, the dark streets of Gaza, Palestinians waved and whispered to me, "Mr. Bob, Mr. Bob Simon." I think it's fair to say there are people all over the world who today will miss the irreplaceable Bob Simon of CBS News, dead at age 73.
Bob Simon is with American forces in Saudi Arabia on the line hours before the deadline in the desert.
And while attention is riveted on precisely when the war will begin, the far more crucial question is when it will end. Bob Simon, CBS News, Saudi Arabia.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation. For increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, giftedandtalented.com, providing personalized online courses developed by Stanford University, designed to help K-12 students advance in mathematics, language arts, and beyond. More at giftedandtalented.com. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
A triple murder in North Carolina and Muslims around the world react. This is from a prayer vigil in Chapel Hill for the victims. Students Dia Barakat, Yusor Mohammed Abu Salah, and her sister Razan Mohammed Abu Salah, all honor students. Dia and Yusor married just 2 months ago. They were allegedly shot to death by Craig Stephen Hicks in a rampage that was not a hate crime, according to his wife Karen.
This incident had nothing to do with religion or victims' faith, but in fact was related to the longstanding parking disputes that my husband had with the neighbors.
Her husband, Stephen Hicks, is being held on 3 counts of first-degree murder. That statement and urgings from the police not to jump to conclusions about a crime still under investigation have not stopped people from imagining their own scenarios.
I don't know if it stems from the woman or the women wearing hijab, you know, the female covering, or what it was about. But, you know, it may have been a combination of things. It may have started with a parking thing and just escalated from there with the way that they looked.
That voice, the neighbor of the victims. The distraught father of Dia Barakat has no doubt that these murders were racially motivated.
We're hoping to get justice here, but in any way you look at it, it's just a hate crime.
Is the Muslim community in North Carolina suddenly under threat and feeling vulnerable? Frank Stacio is host of The State of Things on radio station WUNC, and Dr. Omid Safi is director of Duke University's Islamic Studies Center. He joins us from the university town of Durham, not far from Chapel Hill. Welcome.
Hello, John.
Hi.
First of all, Mr. Safi, or Dr. Safi, what is this sense of vulnerability about this crime as it relates to Muslims in North Carolina? Is there a history and tradition of tension between the communities?
You know, I think there's a tendency sometimes when there's a horrific act like this for people to respond by saying, we can't believe that something like this could happen in a nice place like this. This is a nice place to live. And all of those things are true, of course, about Chapel Hill, about North Carolina. But I also think in some ways, if these acts happen in your community, then they're a part of your community. They're a part of your legacy. So the truth of the matter is that now Chapel Hill and North Carolina and indeed the United States are places where execution-style murder of college Muslims is taking place. And that is indeed making people feel vulnerable and exposed.
Frank Stacio, is a racially and religiously motivated crime an explanation for a senseless act, or is there tension in the communities that has burst forth here?
Well, I'm just going to have to take the or out of that statement. I noticed in your intro you said, is there an Islamic community that is suddenly under siege? No, not suddenly. It's been going on for a long time. That's one question, and it's one answer, and I think it's true, and I think Dr. Safi would agree that tensions, religious tension, and Islamophobia is abroad here in this area, and it's something that Muslim students have to deal with, and would that our greater community would take it more seriously. That said, a horrific crime has been committed. The police are investigating, and there is at this moment, very early in the crime, very early in the investigation, a lot of evidence to suggest that there is perhaps an individual here who was very sensitive to parking and noise and other things. Was that at play? Was this Islamophobia and race hatred and religious tension part of this? We don't know. There's no way to say. Is it a factor here in this region? Of course it is, yes.
How is it a factor? What are the incidents that people point to as they think about what has led up to this here? And are they broadly known incidents, or does everyone have their own personal incident of Islamophobia when you talk to people, Frank?
Well, I think Dr. Safi has a better answer for that. But I'll say this, just the coverage. You know, John, when stories like this happen, we are forced in the media to deal with the fact that now social media has made this. We have to deal with the fact that people are claiming this is a hate crime. And we know better. We know that we have to wait. When somebody is accused of a horrible crime, got to wait until the evidence is in. So there's this terrible pressure on us to weigh what we know to be true, Islamophobia, against a criminal, the record in a criminal trial. So the fact that it's abroad, the fact that so much social media, the fact that there is such awareness of this tells you there's something very serious about it. And I would defer to Dr. Safi to give you specific examples of why he knows this is quite true.
Dr. Safi, how would you contextualize the social media response here? And it's come from all over the world with incidents in individual communities, some of which you may have experienced yourself.
You know, I think I would make two points about it. The first one is that if you take a look nationwide and you look at all of the studies, the Pew study, Washington Post, ABC News, that take a look at the larger American society's view of Muslims, American Muslims, mind you. These are American citizens we're speaking of. We are now 20 points lower than we were immediately after the horrific attacks of September the 11th. Right after 9/11, the number was somewhere around 47, 49%, and now we're down to 27%. There's no other racial or religious community that is viewed with greater dislike. And many of us think that the vitriolic language that we see on many of our public airwaves, and it's not just Fox News, though, of course, that's the loudest one, is largely responsible for this, the endless association of Islam with misogyny, patriarchy, violence, terrorism, extremism. It's a litany that just goes on and on. And so I think that is one factor. In terms of the social media, it's a reality of the world in which we live, and it's a mixed blessing and curse at the same time. One way in which I actually do think in this particular case it has played a positive role is that the local police, the Chapel Hill police, quite understandably, were very slow to release details of this horrific act, slow to release the names of the victims. And of course, in less than 24 hours after the murder, they initially released a statement distancing themselves from the possibility of this being a hate crime, marginalizing it, and then retracting that statement and issuing a second one in which they're fully exploring it. The social media is keeping the pressure on to explore that possibility.
Dr. Omid Safi is director of Duke University's Islamic Studies Center. Frank Statio is host of The State of Things on WUNC in North Carolina. Frank and Doctor, thanks so much.
Good to talk with you.
Good to be with you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings, legal plans featuring attorney contract review, and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Numbers stick in your mind. Like 8675309. Can't get it out of there, right? More on that in just a few minutes. But if you are looking for a bargain for some reason, a dollar to your brain is way more than 99 cents. That's something marketers discovered a long time ago.
I'll tell you what brilliance in advertising is, 99 cents. Somebody thought of that.
Nobody knows who thought of it, but that's Mad Men playing with our heads. It's not just about 99 cents. Turns out that 10 bucks feels like it might be an arbitrary ripoff for a bottle of, say, premium olive oil, but make it $12.67, and suddenly your brain says that the retailer is trying to keep the price under $15 for bargain hunters. Such a deal. You may be smart enough not to be fooled by that old 99-cent trick, but how can $12.67 feel less than an even 10 bucks? Tim Harford writes the Undercover Economist column for the Financial Times, has written extensively on the psychology of pricing. He joins me now. Tim, welcome.
Thank you.
Why does that work? Why does that work?
We're really struggling to figure this out as economists because we really have two different ways of looking at this. One is to say, is there some completely rational reason why these weird prices might make sense? And the other is, I think, to accept the, you know, the pretty straightforward psychological explanation, which is that we're just not fully paying attention to prices. And so we're interpreting them as a kind of signal, as a sort of shorthand for what sort of product this is and whether it's a good deal or whether it's not a good deal. I mean, economists used to think that the whole reason why you would have prices that ended in, you know, 99 cents or 67 cents or whatever was all about keeping the shop assistants honest, because they would always have to make change and then they'd always have to put things through the cash register and then they couldn't rip off the owner. But I think that's probably becoming less and less convincing as an explanation for why we see these strange prices.
But in any other context, $12.67 feels like a completely random, pulled out of a hat number. But all of a sudden, you put it on a product, and we're trying to invent some narrative. Well, $12.67, that's thought through. There must be some accurate reflection of the cost of materials there. But if you put 10 bucks on it, that feels random.
I think one thing we can guarantee is that if you see a price like $12.67, what we know is that the retailer has tried a bunch of different things and has tested it out, and $12.67 is working for the retailer. So we have to figure out why it's working, but they will experiment. And that's particularly true online. If you buy anything, say, on Amazon or from an online supermarket, those prices, they change all the time, and these companies are constantly trying to learn about our buying behavior and, you know, what is the price that gets the maximum margin and also the maximum sales.
So that data at Amazon, I'm always getting these headlines, price that you looked at a product has changed, and it's just like, you know, 7 cents or 6 cents.
2 cents, yeah.
2 cents. They have the data that knows that people act on that.
Yeah, they have a tremendous amount of data, and they'll be changing these things all the time. Some of the Amazon sellers actually just have computer software that will, they're selling through Amazon, and their software is just scanning the rest of Amazon and looking for prices. So there's a famous case of a book about, it was a biology textbook called An Anatomy of a Fly, and it was selling for, I can't remember exactly, but it was something like $23 quadrillion. And the reason was that there were just two sellers who, they both had software robots scanning the other seller's price, and they were in this sort of bidding war. The price was going up and up and up and up and up and up and up. No one was buying, but they were just riffing off each other, and the price got to this crazy level. But normally, we could be assured
that happened. So fantastic. Now, we've just got a few minutes here, but I suspect in wine, this is like a whole sort of field of psychology.
Oh, wine is amazing. So we have a lot of data now that when the bottle of wine is more expensive, or when you're told the bottle of wine is more expensive, it actually tastes better. They have people drinking wine through straws while sitting in brain scans, and the brain is acting differently. And, you know, you're told it's a $50 bottle of wine versus a $10 bottle of wine. Of course, it's the same wine. You know, the psychologists don't tell you that. And you think, you believe the $50 bottle of wine tastes better. The shape of the wine glass, all of these things alter our perceptions. Fascinatingly, there are some guys at Yale, I say guys, Laurie Santos is the head of this project.
Right.
She's a psychologist. Some guys at the Comparative Cognition Lab at Yale who are doing this sort of research on Capuchin monkeys. The monkeys have learned to trade, they learned to buy and sell stuff. And the monkeys are not impressed by the information that some Jell-O or a snack or something is normally really expensive. They do not care. Whereas humans, in this respect, humans are much stupider than monkeys, because we're really impressed simply by the idea that it's expensive. Oh, it must be good. The monkeys don't care.
It's also a moving target. I mean, it seems like back in the 60s, you were smart if you got the 99-cent sale. But now if you buy wine for 99 cents, you're perceived as stupid.
I don't know. I have not seen good data on how these prices are changing. But what I do know is when I wrote about this recently, I did a press search, because there'd been a media article said, companies are now, they're all switching to round numbers. So $4, $10, $20, they don't bother with 95 cents or 99 cents. And I did a press search and I found the same story basically from 2005 and the same story from the early 1990s. So, you know, every now and then someone in the media gets excited about the idea that there's this brand new pricing model. I'm not sure actually anything is quite so new when it comes to retail.
But spring first run suits at a men's store on Savile Row is definitely worth $7,000, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
I'm sure of it.
Yeah,
I'm sure of it. If you say so and I say so, everyone believes it.
Pricing and the Brain, Tim Harford writes the Undercover Economist column for the Financial Times. Thanks so much, Tim.
Thank you.
How else should we play it?
What you're listening to is a fabulous little bit of pop music history. Chances are you know this number, 867-5309. No area code, just the 7 digits. Immortal because of this 80s hit song, the actual title of which you may not know, Jenny. That was her number.
Jenny, Jenny, who can I turn to? You give me something I can hold on to.
And this song for Jim Keller and Tommy Heath was lightning in a bottle for one unforgettable moment back in the 1980s when they both thought they had it made.
It's part of a cultural phenomenon where people sing all the parts and everything. And it appears to be that I was the guy that did that, but I have a tenuous hold on reality, so I don't really, I can't be sure that it was me that did it, but everyone says it's me. I'll just go out and sing it.
You can't screw that song up. If you hear a really bad bar band playing that, it's fantastic. If you hear, it's almost better than a great band, but a terrible band playing this song, it's hysterical.
Well, kids can play it really fast, too.
Jenny, you're the girl for me. You don't know me, but you make me so darn happy.
Heath and Keller were the two main musicians of the band Tommy Two Tone. Keller and songwriter Alex Call wrote Jenny, and Tommy Heath did the vocal and the arrangement that made the song famous. This is the first time Heath and Keller have sat down and played this song in 30 years. You might say this song was one of the anthems that announced the arrival of the 1980s. Jenny was the name of the tune, but by the time it made number 4 on the Billboard Top 100 in 1982, everyone knew it as 867-5309. The band was a rock and roll machine called Tommy Two Tone. The song, which may have caused some regret for people named Jenny, has continued to disrupt the mathematical world. This twin prime number was cited by Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan as the fourth most common password in a recent case about internet security. When the number becomes available in an area code and offered for auction, there is a predictable mob scene. Tommy Heath and Jim Keller got together back in the late 1970s. Keller was a carpenter and a self-taught guitarist. Heath was a trained musician who dropped out of piano studies to try the pop scene. There's no debate about the popularity of the number in their song, 867-5309. But I was surprised to learn that Jim Keller and Tommy Heath have very different stories about that mysterious Jenny.
Well, I was writing...
Well, we have different versions of that. So.
Well, I was on a busman's holiday from working with Tommy, and there's a guy named Alex Call, who is a good buddy of mine, who is a great, great songwriter. And he and I were writing songs together. And I literally went out to his crib. He had this storage container out near San Quentin, on the road out there that was guys would use as like studios. And I got out there and basically Alex had written this thing and I showed up and I went, what the hell is that? And so we played it. We finished it together, this song. And then I brought this into our band. And I think everybody that heard it, you know, you didn't know what was good about it, but just that progression was intoxicating. And so Tommy heard that and then he started singing it and, you know, it was fun from the very beginning, that track.
And what's your version? We're not going to end anything here.
Well, since they wrote it, I happen to know Jenny, and she claims...
You know Jenny?
Yes, I do. And I still talk to her once in a while. I promised I'd never tell anybody where she lived or anything. And it was her parents' number. So that's my version.
I didn't know that.
You went out with her once.
You went out with her once?
I'm not...
He doesn't
no
remember.
Comment.
No comment.
So there is a girl named Jenny with the number.
There are a lot of Jennies in the world.
A lot of Jennies, a lot of numbers. Yeah,
we all have our own Jenny, but I have mine, I guess.
This past week, exactly 30 years after playing their final show together, the band members Jim Keller and Tommy Heath reunited for a performance at a venue on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. They've lived very different lives over the last 30 years. Tommy has continued to play music and tours constantly. His daughter is studying astrophysics at Columbia University. Jim Keller is a successful manager for composer Philip Glass, is married to a successful fashion art director. They have a teenage daughter. Heath and Keller spoke about what it's like to catch lightning in a bottle one magical time.
We had a hit on the first record, so it actually wasn't the first thing that we had. We had the song called Angels Say No, which was a top 40 single on the first record. Obviously, no one remembers that song. And when 867 came out, what happens is that was a top 5 single. And all of a sudden, you go from being like a successful pop band to all of a sudden your mother's friends know who you are because they see you on People magazine in the shopping line. And so there's this whole, like, you know, whatever, that 1% thing that starts happening, where the recognizability and all that stuff really changed completely for a short period of time, might add.
Did you deal with that differently as personalities?
Yeah, we walked through some all the 80s things and survived and did it differently.
We did exactly what you're supposed to do when you're a pop band.
Which was
you take that rise, you have a great, great time, you hit the peak, and you crash and burn when you get to the other side. Which is, let's face it, I mean, that's what pop bands, that's what pop culture is about. And people always say, well, why did you guys break up? And I just laugh, because it's the question is, why did these other bands stay together? You're not supposed to. You're not built for longevity. You know, and there's something really fantastic about that little thing that happens. And, you know, sure, we go, you know, there's the aftermath, which is not pretty for almost anybody who goes through the flips of the other side of that arc. But it's a great little thing to watch, you know, and to be a part of.
Where did you crash and burn?
Well, it started in California. You know, when the band went down, I went down with it, you know, and it's like, okay, what do I do now? You know, you're basically trained to, you know, when you're trained to be in a rock band, I'm not quite sure where that leads you after that, you know.
Carpenter, rock band.
Well, you know, you're just being a pop star. And we had enough of that success that it, like, what do you do after that? And the money dries up, and it's a little tricky, and it takes a while to figure it out for most everybody.
How did you crash and burn, if you did?
Well, we had, instead of cashing in on our second album, we decided to do the big concept album, and we worked on our third album for 2 years, and all these geniuses at CBS that had made us famous all got fired. And it was just like, I think I'll take a year off and go back home to Mendocino, and then I'll come down and do it again, and never figured out quite how to do it again. So,
One of your main gigs is being a manager for Philip Glass?
Yeah.
Right. Do you remember when you told Philip that you're behind this song?
Well,
it's
wasn't
a little different
really,
style for him.
You know, Philip is not that attuned to the pop music scene, certainly from the 80s, but I remember there was one moment that was funny where I was in my office, and I had a gold record from our career that was on the floor, which I never hung on the wall. It had arrived, and I put it over the floor, and Philip came in and said, oh, is that one of mine? And I said, Philip, it's a gold single. I don't think so.
So you've had a gold single, and he's never had.
Well, he's had plenty of other gold things, but not a single, not a pop single. And I have to say, there's something so cool about a hit single. You know, to me, as a songwriter, it's like the guys that I worship, you know, whether it's Ray Davies or these brilliant, you know, guys that make pop records, you know, David Byrne, you know, people who have that, can take and bottle that magic, to me, send shivers up my spine to this day. And to be a part of any kind of little piece of that is really unique and special.
Thank you very much.
The reunited Tommy Two-Tone, Jim Keller and Tommy Heath, brought their bottled magic back to the stage one more time and opened up for a New York crowd that was thrilled to hear 867-5309 and those familiar chords.
Y'all know this one. Something I couldn't hold on to.
you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.